I'm Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson. And together we are
a Jew
and a Gentile
walk into a bar
mitzvah.
Wishing I could change the things that I screwed up. What am I supposed to do? I can't give up. You know I can't give up.
Well, welcome to a Jew and a Gentile Walk into a Bar Mitzvah, the podcast, episode 59. Podcast where we'll discuss everything from the sarcastic to the profane. I'm Charles Breton. I'm usually doing the sarcasm. And Chris Henson, the Gentile, is usually doing the profanity. Chris is not joining us this week. He is doing some professional development. But fear not, for I have searched all over literally Christendom, or at least the corner of Christendom in Asheboro, North Carolina, to find a suitable Gentile co-host. And I'm just ecstatic that I did, and well, I didn't really search. She was the first person I asked because she was the first person I thought would be perfect, and she said yes. So, taking the place of Chris for this podcast, singer, songwriter, artist, host of Beer and Hymns in Asheboro, North Carolina at Four Saints Brewery, shameless plug, all around everything has to do with music at Wild Goose, friend of the show, all around great person, Kristen Lee Southworth.
Hey, everybody. I'm happy to fill in with as much profanity as needed.
which is why you're on
Chris's
behalf,
of course.
Yeah, which is why you're on the top of my list. Yeah, thanks for sitting in. Yeah, Chris was a little concerned this week. He doesn't always like when I see other Gentiles.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, but then again, living in Davie County, he really doesn't have, I don't have to worry, he doesn't have to see that many Jews. When I'm in Davie County, North Carolina, the number of Jews doubles.
So does that mean you get to disagree with yourself?
Oh, all the well, I do that anyway.
There you go.
I do that anyway. Just want to take a minute and acknowledge the sponsors, our good friends of the podcast. As always, we want to thank Pastor Nar and Brandon Mauser of Men of the Beard Oil, Virgil Kane, the Robert Baron Rye Whiskey, official rye whiskey of a Jew and a Gentile. Pipe and Pint, Triad's oldest brick and mortar tobacconist and the finest humidor in the Southeast. And Four Saints Brewing Company in Asheboro, North Carolina, some of the best beer ever. And on the first Sunday of every month, they host Beer and Hymns led by the incomparable Kristen Lee Southworth. And I have to say that we took a friend to Beer and Hymns this last week, our friend AJ. Mm. And first of all, finally got her to drink a good beer. So
What did she try?
I got her a sampler with the new winter IPA, which was astounding. The Hefeweizen, the Omi, and the Potter's Clay.
Oh, the Potter's Clay is my favorite.
That's my go-to.
Yep, me too.
Yep.
Every time.
So she really enjoyed it. And she also enjoyed the hymns. She was having a good time singing. And I explained to her that we had met, you and I had met at Wild Goose. But it's strange because I was explaining to her that you're the Wild Goose version of the band. that it seemed like. Did you ever get off the main stage the whole weekend? We need someone with a guitar. Quick, grab Kristen. We need a backup singer. Grab Kristen. We've got 15 minutes to grab Kristen.
I've made my rounds at the festival. Yeah, I was a part of the festival from the first year, so I've gotten to know some folks over the years. So.
Yeah, see, every time we went by the stage, you were up there. But also the other thing that we wanted to talk about, we're not smoking, no cigar reviews, but we're drinking, which is almost as good. And I know that you are an old-fashioned girl.
Yes, I am.
So you're drinking old-fashions.
Mm-hmm. With a Woodford whiskey in there.
Okay. Well, it's not Virgil Caine, but that's okay. It's still a good bourbon. And you're using your fiance Joe Mitchell's family recipe. And Joe's on our podcast also. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right. So apparently this is your family recipe for the old-fashioned. It's a little different.
A little bit. We don't muddle the cherries. We're anti-orange in our family.
At least since 2017.
Maybe because we're Scottish. I don't know. We use any number of kinds of bourbon. I like Woodford Reserve personally. I spent 3 years living in Kentucky. So you live there and you have bourbon for breakfast. So you start to get something of a taste for it. And, so some bourbon, club soda, bitters, little bit of sugar and, three cherries. 'Cause that's what my grandmother used.
So. Okay. All right. Sounds
and a
good.
Lot of ice. My grandfather demanded a lot of ice.
A lot of ice.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So, well, that's also a little different. That's always something people have, how much ice, because how much you want it diluted.
Mm-hmm.
But, right. Well, we're going to have to do some bourbon tasting then.
Absolutely.
And I really enjoy it. So I had made some for New Year's. Of course, I use Virgil Cane rye because I like I'm really getting into ryes right now. And what I did this time is I put some orange zest in with the bitters and sugar.
Mm. Mm.
So instead of just having the orange wheel, I mix it in. Wow, that really brightened it up a lot.
Mm. Huh.
Nice.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. So
try that.
So it might move you a little bit, just, maybe not the whole orange slice, but put a little zest in there. Yeah.
And the whole slice kind of gets in the way, so a little bit of orange is all right.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't do the whole wheel. I just did the little wedge.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want anything drowning out the bourbon.
Right.
So we also have another special guest because we're doing a special podcast. If you've been aware of what's going on in the world, you know that the new Star Wars Last Jedi is out, and there's been a lot of interesting discussion out on the web machines about whether or not it follows the other, whether it's canonical or not, but also just the theology of Star Wars and the Jedi as a religion and how that represents. So not only I have Kristen and Joe, but we're also joined by Rabbi Esther Hugenholtz, rabbi, teacher of Torah, opener of doors, servant of the Holy One, writer of songs, drinker of tea, mom of two.
Yes.
Yes.
And and writer of bad Twitter profiles.
Well, it works for this. So you had a very interesting thread on Twitter. Because what's interesting is, for me, the first three in terms of 4, 5, and 6, the first movies that came out, very much follow Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, and Lucas has talked about that. The 1, 2, and 3 seem to have a much more of a Christian theology, a lot of savior myth and Messiah and the chosen one. And these two, especially the last one, for me, seemed to have more of a connection to Judaism.
Right.
And,
There was definitely a Judaic vibe, or at least a vibe that Jews can tap into and understand as a Judaic vibe. I wouldn't want to appropriate the whole Star Wars mythos to fit Judaism exclusively, but there were definitely themes that resonates strongly for Jews and that have led to some discussions in the Jewish blogosphere and in different Jewish articles about Star Wars and its merits. Mm-hmm. So, I am not a Star Wars expert. I am just a congregational rabbi who enjoys science fiction and fantasy. And I enjoy watching and reading science fiction and fantasy through a Jewish lens. And I decided to tweet some stuff out. So that's it.
And there were some very interesting things. First of all, there if you haven't seen the movie, there's going to be spoiler alerts. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's shocking. You know, Chewbacca dies right after the opening credits. Of course, the most shocking is that Rey's father is Kaiser Sose.
Yeah.
But they had to reshoot.
Nobody saw that coming.
Yeah. But they had
to reshoot. Now you got to leave a little more time between their spoilers and throwing Chewbacca in front of the intergalactic bus here.
I do. Well, I'm still getting the hang of all this stuff. You know, of course, they had to reshoot everything with Kaiser Sose because, you know, they had to get another actor in. Anyway, one of the things, Robert, that you had talked about is the whole concept of balance and balancing the force. And also very important was, especially from the Jewish perspective, of lineage versus choice.
Yeah, so that is the thing that was the hook that I decided to pin my little Twitter article on, because there was another article that critiqued Star Wars, or at least this latest film, The Last Jedi, for basically disregarding the importance of tradition and lineage. And according to this author, Star Wars felt less authentic, or this latest, you know, this latest movie felt less authentic because of that. And, you know, a bunch of colleagues and myself started talking about that. And I realized that, you know, after I'd seen a movie, I had to wait until I could, you know, get a babysitter and see the movie. you know, how that kind of played into Jewish understandings of lineage versus choice, and Rey's journey in terms of accepting who she is and making a choice to be a Jedi, to basically become a Jedi by choice. Mm-hmm. So that's something I focused on because I think that's a very relevant discussion in the Jewish world right now. I think that we are at a paradigm shift in the Jewish world in which our assumptions and understandings of what makes a Jew or who is a Jew or how Judaism is transmitted is being destabilized. You know, the old loyalties of, you know, I'm going to be a member of the synagogue because my Bobby and Zadie were members of synagogues, are not as strong for the current generation of millennials and even Gen Xers. Or extennials like myself, right? And so I think the Jewish world has to, you know, at least in the North American contemporary liberal iteration, has to come to terms with answering this question: who are we? How do we transmit our values? But also, how do we allow people to opt in and to choose walking the path of Judaism and all that's meaningful about it? And I kind of saw that parallel in The Last Jedi, where you know, the saga has kind of meandered in and out of this storyline of, you know, Luke, I am your father, you know, Darth Vader saying that, you know, he is the father of Luke Skywalker. And even in the trilogy that shall remain nameless because it wasn't, it left a little something to be desired cinematographically and what else, you know, they even kind of ramped up on this lineage element by introducing midichlorians, which wasn't, you know, canonical to the first trilogy. That was, you know, the prequel trilogy introduced that. Well, all of a sudden, this genetic determinist element was introduced that you can only feel the force or control the force or have a gift for the force if you have this DNA, if you have this kind of biological heritage. And, you know, like, In the Jewish tradition, throughout Kabbalistic sources and other sources, you will see a similar discussion between, you know, what does it mean to be a Jew by birth versus what does it mean to be a Jew by choice. You'll see some of this in Yehuda Halevi's writings, like El Kuzari, the Kuzari, where he talks that you know, you can be a convert, that's all fine and dandy, but only born Jews of the Zera Kodesh, of the Holy Seed, have Nevi'ut, have full access to prophecy, right? And of course, you know, then there's the other side in the argument, you know, promulgated by thinkers like Maimonides, the Rambam, who argue actually, you know, there is nothing genetically essentialist about being Jewish. It's about accepting the yoke of the commandments and considering yourself part of the covenant, whether that's through birth or through choice. There is no difference ontologically between those two ways to have Jewish status. So when I saw the movie, that's kind of where my mind went in terms of what I had heard other Jewish commentators write about the film, and you know what had been prompted in my own thinking. And so what's remarkable about Ray is that she doesn't have this lineage, and she's hoping to have that special lineage. In the film, she is demonstrated as expressing a hope, you know, who were my parents? She asks Kylo this question, you know, who were my parents? She's really hoping that she can latch into this, or latch onto this foundational narrative of, I have this intergalactic cosmic lineage that links me to the Force, and that explains my gifts. But then, you know, if we are to take Kylo Ren's statement at face value, he actually shatters her hopes and says, your parents were nobodies. They were basically drunks who were, you know, who basically gambled you away. Or, you know, we are left to kind of fill in the details, but it sounds like not a very stable and certainly not a very prestigious home environment. So we learn at that moment that Rey has a natural aptitude for the Force, but she doesn't have midichlorians. She doesn't have this lineage, but yet she goes through this transformative process of accepting upon herself the yoke of the Jedi commandments, and does something that's very Abrahamic, right? On the one hand, she is an iconoclast. Yoda speaks to her. She sets the Jedi temple on fire, right? And she is prepared to kind of tear down what has become this calcified heritage. But on the other hand, she still smuggles the sacred texts with her as she escapes. And that is revealed at the very end of the film, that you get this little shot of the Jedi sacred literature that she has taken with her. And that kind of really reminded me of Yohanan ben Zakkai, who was smuggled out of Jerusalem. You know, this is a story from the Mishnah, from the Tanaitic, late, you know, early rabbinic literature in late antiquity, for all the people out there who might not be familiar with that corpus of literature. The Romans have conquered Jerusalem. They've burnt down the temple. And Judaism at that point is at a real kind of, you know, junction in its survival. And, you know, some people fought to the death to defend the temple and lost the fight. And Judaism is in crisis at that moment. And then one of the early rabbis, one of the Pharisees, Yohanan ben Zakkai, says, I need to survive and escape and take the tradition with me. So he escapes in a coffin from, you know, the burning capital, and, you know, eventually sets up a learning academy in Yavne and becomes the founder of this new incredible legacy that we would call rabbinic Judaism nowadays, and was instrumental in its survival. By burning down the old, you create the fertilizer for the new, right? So, and I feel like those were like these wonderful Judaic moments in Star Wars, where Rey realizes that she needs to continue this tradition, but in a new way that speaks to the challenges of her time, but without forgetting the roots, but also not relying on this idea of, I need to have lineage. Judaism is open to all who want to partake of it and who want to commit to that value system. And that's kind of what I tweeted out as well, where I talked about, you know, the Torah being Hefker. There's this great Midrash from Midrash Rabbah that talks about you know, why was the Torah given in the desert, in the wilderness? Why wasn't it given in the land of Israel? It would make more sense to conceive of the Torah being given in the land of Israel. It's the Holy Land. It, you know, looms very large in biblical imagination. Why was it given in this random desert between Egypt and Israel or Canaan? And the rabbis answer, because, you know, fire, water, and the wilderness are free. They're open. And you have to make yourself open. And it's an open space that people who want can claim. So that's kind of my perush, kind of my drash, my explanation and my interpretation of the film. And I thought it was wonderful in that sense, where we managed to break free from these very traditional hero tropes and hero archetypes, that the hero is actually someone who has this hidden amazing lineage, which is aristocratic or remarkable in some way, but then actually, you know, he has to come into that. Well, no, Ray is a completely unremarkable person in terms of her lineage, but she's this remarkable person through her choice. And I think that's a message that we in the Jewish community can co-opt, apart, you know, in parallel with the message that Jewish transmission, the dor v'dor, from generation to generation, is really powerful, and that transmitting Judaism through family structures is essential and powerful. There's also this other way to be Jewish in the world, and Ray kind of showcased that.
Yeah, you know, there's so much.
Sorry.
No, there's so much in your thread and all these things. And I want to bring Joe and Chris in, because they unfortunately missed our podcast on the Reformation. And does it have a future? And among the many, many things that... No
is the answer.
No is the answer to that one. Well, that was quick. And you know, so thanks, folks.
That's not my fight.
Yeah. But it's... I think there's some parallel discussion in terms of, you know, what is the new tradition? Right. What is the new way? And how do you take, you know, from the old, but find this new direction? You know, again, is the parallel in a lot of discussions, in especially with the evangelical movement, with ex-evangelicals, former evangelicals, trying to unclaim and reclaim and rework that in sort of the same way, that I don't need to be a member of this church just because this is the one I grew up in. I need to find the church that fits my values, and sort of the way Ray is searching. How would you see this playing out in evangelical and progressive Christian world?
Well, I think every tradition struggles with these polarities.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Joe, Kristen.
There's a lot there. you know, when you think about the evangelical world, especially just looking at the Reformation more broadly, and how I root the Reformation actually in the Great Schism of 1054. I think that split set the groundwork for a later the way that the Roman Church set itself up kind of against the Eastern churches kind of created a model for others to then do that, and then so I sort of see the Protestant Reformation as multitudes of different Christian groups kind of taking after the Romans, in a sense, and that sort of repeating itself in infinity until, you know, we sort of are at this point now, all these many centuries later, with I think like over 50,000 denominations that are considered Christian, you know, and it's also it's almost reached a point of absurdity, and I think there's a lot of rearranging going on, and you could talk categorically about what's happening and why, and what are some of those new categories right now. But
when I think about, especially the what you were talking about in terms of reclaiming, one thing that stands out to me is, and thinking about it in the context of a conversation about The Last Jedi and Star Wars, was Rey's move of taking those texts off that island and claiming them for her own. I think that is powerful in the sense of saying, no, you don't need to be part of some grand lineage. And it's not something you inherit as DNA, as genetic, as a part of your family. But it's important. The tradition matters, right? Mm-hmm. Tradition matters, and retaining tradition matters. I actually love the scene. I mean, the scene with Luke and Yoda by that tree, and Luke's sort of about to, you know, it's interesting. I think that there's so much I could say or would love to say about things that I see going on theologically in the whole Star Wars saga. But what I loved about The Last Jedi, what I love about The Last Jedi, especially, is how it brings to light so much of the sense of conflict as a theme within the Skywalker family. That's mm-hmm. the sort of heritage and legacy of the Skywalkers, is this conflict between the dark and the light. And so you see these moments of like hesitation and conflict, both in Kylo and in Luke. And obviously that's something that was going on throughout Anakin's life. And so I love that scene where he goes to burn down the tree and then he hesitates, and then Yoda comes and just strikes it down with the lightning. Because he knows, you know, those books are already gone. Rey's mm-hmm. already got them on the Millennium Falcon. You know, she's gone. So, but for Luke, you know, he thinks that the traditions now, it's all going up in flames. And anyway, getting back to the original point, that I think it's significant that she does take those texts. I think that a lot of what I see the evangelical church doing, and a lot of different groups who are claiming and reclaiming and reinventing and newly inventing various things, is that there's not a sense of groundedness in tradition. And there's a lack of kind of a basic curiosity, interest, and respect for tradition. And so without that kind of relationship, in some ways you see the new kind of, I see that as, that's sort of, I think both Rey and Kylo are on a similar page in a way. You know, they both want to get rid of the old and usher mm-hmm. in something new. But Kylo wants to get rid of everything that came before. Right. He mm-hmm. just says, screw it. We're done. We're done with this. Let it burn to the ground. Let it all die. Kill it if you have to. But Rey is, no, that it matters to be in relationship with this thing that came before, this wisdom that came before, and all that was learned, including, you know, the good, bad, the ugly, and the failure, and that being part of it. But that to me is a significant piece of, a parallel that I see going on with some of the sort of newer versions of Christianity. I'm kind of someone who stands on both ends of that. I so appreciate kind of contemporary movements and new creative life being breathed into, you know, Christianity and faith and the church, but always with a responsibility to the tradition as a whole, which I think most of the Protestant churches really lost sight of a long, long time ago. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Joe, I want to bring you in here. I don't know if this is necessarily where you want to go, but another, I think, important thread to pull out is certainly one of the things that is also rejected in this set of final movies is determinism. And there was a lot of emphasis in the first six on destiny and fate, and that those things controlling actions. And Rey represents a break from that, and even a lot of the tension from Luke is trying to fight that, and maybe tension in Kylo as well. Do you see anywhere that we might be informed about this idea of free will, of it's about the choices you make, or are things determined for us and we just follow a path? How would you answer that if someone came to you and said, Father Joe, am I just, on this path? Is this fate, or, how much is it that we're Rey? Ben Solo kind of seems fated to become Kylo Ren. Anakin was fated to become Darth Vader. Mm-hmm. Luke's not sure what he was fated to be, but everyone kept telling him, follow your destiny. And now we're getting Finn, who's rewriting his own future and his past. Rey, who's doing the same thing. So where do we balance the free will and the destiny?
I think back to Han's line in the first film. There's no mystical energy field that controls my destiny. It's all just a bunch of simple tricks and nonsense. It's interesting, we talk about, Ben Solo was fated to become Kylo Ren and Anakin Skywalker was fated to become Darth Vader, but we've sort of watched their stories unfold from the perspective of now. We didn't get to see Anakin's story unfold from the beginning to his fall. We saw him fall first. And so even while watching that story unfold, we know where it's going to go. So we said, there's the killing of the Tusken Raiders. There's the arrogance as a child. Oh yeah, of course he's going to become Darth Vader. Mm-hmm. And even somewhat with Ben becoming Kylo again, we see him first in that role. We see him first as Kylo Ren before we ever even know that he's Ben Solo. Luke is a little different. Luke and Rey have a similar path in that when we meet them, they are nobody. I think that's one of the great things about the closing shot in The Last Jedi. There's a lot of talk about that little boy who uses the Force to pull the broom and then to sweep up the barn. And some have said, he's going to be the hero of Rian Johnson's next trilogy and all this. And I'm sitting here going, I don't care if he is, all right. But I'd actually prefer not for that to happen, because that boy in that last scene represents everything that was so great about Star Wars in its infancy, that this farm boy, forget Empire, forget Return of the Jedi for a second, but just the first film, that this farm boy, this nobody, in the Outer Rim, which just when you just say that, you just know he's way off on the periphery. He's not a part of the story. He is not supposed to be a part of the story. There's a wonderful deleted scene in the first movie where Luke is watching a battle happen in the stars, and he laments the fact that he doesn't get to be a part of this. And his friend Biggs even tells him, that's not really your place. He is constantly being told by his friends and by his family, look, this is not who you are. And Rey has such a similar path that when we first see her, she's a nobody, and that's confirmed, of course, in that scene in The Last Jedi. And the whole time between The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi, every conversation was, she's got to be a Skywalker. she's mm-hmm. a Kenobi, or she's right. a Palpatine, or my favorite was she's the reincarnation of Anakin Skywalker. that the Force decided needed to be born. And for me, that's, you can say what you want about the prequels. Kristen and I sort of share a similar view on the prequels, that in principle, in structure, they work. The execution, however, was lacking in many ways. But one of the things that as you alluded to earlier, the Christian undercurrent of the prequels, that, oh, there was no father for Anakin, immediately we're set up right there. Yeah. To say, oh yeah, this guy's special. But the beauty of Luke's narrative and Rey's now as we see it unfold is this narrative that anyone and everyone can be a hero or heroine. And that's what that boy represents at the end. And as I read the Gospels, for example, and I look at the ministry of Jesus, and I look at the individuals that followed him, and look at Jesus himself, by all accounts, this is not an individual or a group of people that should have any lasting impact on their own culture, let alone the entire world. Jesus was one of countless rabbis. He wasn't the only one to whom the title Messiah had been attached. There were plenty of others. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it's this guy, maybe it's this guy, maybe it's this guy. By all accounts, the story should have ended. And yet, to me, I don't know if it's destiny. That's one of those things theologically mm-hmm. that I kind of wrestle with. But that the divine, in our case, God, in Star Wars case, the Force, is able to take even a nobody and do extraordinary things with that one. And is that the will of the divine for all of those things to happen, or does that individual create his or her own destiny on their own? To me, that's dualism. That's saying right. it's got to be one or the other. And if there's anything that The Last Jedi teaches us, is that dualism doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And that scene where Kylo and Rey are both trying to pull Anakin / Luke's lightsaber to themselves and it shatters, mm-hmm. is the moment where our old paradigms of what is the nature of the Force, what is the nature of the Jedi and the Sith, this dualism breaks down. Luke has a wonderful moment in his first lesson with Rey, where he says, to say that if the Jedi disappear, the light is gone, the Force is gone, that's vanity. The Force does not belong to the Jedi, which means it doesn't belong to the Sith either. It is, as he says, it dwells in the space between all things. It is liminal, as God is liminal, and thus not dualistic. And so that either or sort of question of, well, you know, is all of this predestined? This Presbyterian friends might have some issues with me. Is all this predestined to happen, or did we create it all ourselves? Yes, it's that it's more like a partnership, and that's the thing about being, you know, a Jedi seeks a relationship with the Force. One of the cool things about these new films is that they've shown us. Particularly in the character of Maz Kanata, they've shown us individuals who are in relationship with the Force, know the Force, could even maybe say are followers of the Force, but are not Jedi. Mm-hmm. And so that says right there that it's not a matter of, you know, if you follow the will of the Force, that makes you a Jedi. We're seeing individuals who have an understanding and a relationship with the Force that is not operating out of this dualism. And why does the Reformation not have a future? That's so many of our Christian churches that were birthed out of the Reformation have operated out of, you're either this or you're this. If you don't agree with this, then that you're not one of us, therefore you're one of them. And we're seeing this in so many particularly mainline Christian churches that are dying for that very reason. And if they continue to operate out of this dualism model, then they will die. But if there's a willingness to see that there is a third way, and one of many, many things you can say about Jesus is he operated out of a third way. He operated out of a model that said to, you know, those who wanted to start an insurrection against Rome and those who said we should just, you know, abide by them and they'll be good to us. He operated out of a place that was not either one of those. And so for me as a Christian, part of my relationship with Jesus is the struggle to always try to find a third way. And in The Last Jedi, you see Rey really, so you see Rey and Kylo both show that, but when Kylo offers his hand out and says, "Join me," and he says, no, you're still holding back," that he doesn't get it. She gets it. I think that's why she leaves Acto and doesn't try to stay, doesn't doesn't give up. Once she sees that the legend, the one that she thought was going to save them, does not do it, she says, "Okay, I'm gonna take a different path." Mm-hmm. So it's that call to finding sort of a middle way that I think is so important, and these films have done such a wonderful job of showing that, and I think particularly these last two have done it in such a way that says, you know, the things that we thought we knew aren't really that anymore. It doesn't mean that what was there before doesn't matter. They have their place, but now, behold, I make all things new. Behold, the Spirit is doing something new. The Force has awakened. The Force is doing something new and is now calling these individuals to something that has not been seen before. And it is a third way. So that's one of the great gifts that I've seen out of these first two films so far.
And I think that makes it a very contemporary movie in many ways. It's addressing the concerns of the millennial age. It's just addressing the concerns of people who want to democratize their spirituality and open up their identity to break away from these binaries. What I hear the two of you say as Christians resonates with me as a Jew, because even though each of our traditions would phrase it in different ways, I think at the core of it, we're struggling with the same questions and we're struggling with how to make sense of a world that is rejecting these binaries more and more in favor for a model of grace. Yeah. You know, and that's a concept that our traditions share. And I think that's actually incredibly empowering. It's destabilizing and unsettling, but in a good way. And I think that a lot of what we're seeing play out religiously and even politically today is a reaction, a backlash against, you know, this new movement, what you would call this third way, and people feeling, having all sorts of feelings about that. about wanting to root themselves into in their identity in a stronger way, in a backlash against that, or however you want to unpack that. So, you know, I think that is also particularly beautiful. And, you know, what you would see as Jesus doing that, I see as, you know, the early rabbinic tradition doing that. And it's interesting how we're both kind of taking the metaphor of Star Wars and implanting this in this very formative age for both our faith traditions, which was actually a pretty similar age, and also to kind of extend the metaphor, an age when both our traditions were innovating and also reacting against the force of empire, i.e. the Roman Empire, and both our traditions. And, you know, it raises a lot of questions about power and authority and sacred rebellion, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, Chris would be very happy that I'm not the one who is blowing up binary oppositions. I even did that in class today, in a freshman writing class. I reject all of Western thought.
Single-handedly.
not single-handedly, but, you know, I'm a Jew, so I think in an Eastern way. I think rabbinically. Judaism is an Eastern religion, and Plato and everything's a binary opposition. My mantra is binary oppositions beget choice, choice begets privilege, and then privilege begets everything that's wrong with the world. But in the dualism, though, another thing that both our traditions share, and again, Chris will be happy that I didn't have to bring up Rambam, because an episode doesn't go by that I don't. But you talk about having to have the balance, which Rambam referred to as the golden mean, that you never have too much of any one thing. And I think for me, the heartache I saw for me in Luke rejecting anything having to do with the dark side.
Yes.
And he could not understand Rey embracing
going down
it.
That hole.
Right. But she understood balance. You have to have both. And I think that's why she's more of a future than, you know, Anakin, who only went to the dark side, Luke, who only went to the light side. Rey is Rambam's golden mean.
Right. And, you know, it kind of really meshes with this midrash, you know, in the cardinal prayer, the Shema, you know, hear O Israel, the eternal is our God, the eternal one. Is one, and you know, the Vahavta, which is the passage which follows on from it, it said, "B'chol levavcha, you shall, you know, love the eternal your God with all your heart." And it says, "B'chol levavcha," instead of "B'chol livcha," with so "livcha" is the singular, which you would expect with all your heart, but what the text actually says is with all your hearts, with your two hearts. And the rabbis interpret this to refer to the Yetzara and the Yetzar Tov, you know, right? The inclination to do bad and the inclination to do good. And that we all have to conquer those, but also balance those. And when Rey decides to go down into that dark pit, which was a brilliant scene, it was brilliant that she was in this hall of mirrors. She had to confront her own demons. And break that binary. And you're right. I think that was a very formative moment, and that was actually allowing her to lehit gaber, you know, to control and govern and conquer those inclinations within her, not by negating them, but by embracing them. And that ultimately leads to her redemptive success, I think.
Absolutely.
I want to say something too about the whole midi-chlorians thing.
Yeah.
Because I feel
which I thought was really weird in the other ones.
And I'm going to do this weird thing that most people don't do, which is I'm going to defend the prequels a little bit.
You're a hero.
Yeah, I know. So because it's interesting that you all say that that you feel the prequels have a sort of Christianity to them. And I can see that in the sort of, like, you know, I guess the virgin birth is like the obvious metaphor and the chosen one. But in terms of the story, when I think about the story, what is striking to me about what the prequels set up in terms of the universe that led to the rise of the Empire and the fall of the Jedi. Was a complicating of the idea of who was good and who was evil. Mm-hmm. And because you had a very arrogant Jedi council that believed and I'm not sure, I haven't done like a ton of, you know, I don't know how much biological research you can do on midichlorians, but but I always interpreted that as this means by which, you know, the Jedi had figured out how to measure whether or not a person was in some way strong with the Force. Mm-hmm. And that there was some measurable quality within them that they could quantify that in some way. Whether or not that's genetic, I don't know, is ever really implied. I think it certainly, there's the implication that it does run in families, but there's also a lot of younglings there that are, mm-hmm. you know, not from families. They're people who have been identified as this person is strong with the Force for mm-hmm. whatever reason. And so we will train them as Jedi. And they create this proliferation of Jedi. It's interesting when you talk about balance, and the balance being this very Eastern kind of notion, mm-hmm. And the original trilogy really has clearly a lot of and coming out of the Joseph Campbell tradition, a lot of Taoist influences, mm-hmm. And a lot of thinking about. My theological perspective on this is very interesting because I was one of those people who like considered myself before I was a Christian. I considered myself, if I had a religion at all, it was like the Force. I was one of those weirdos. So, I took this stuff sort of seriously, but I think I was very drawn to Taoism and Buddhism at that time. And I interpreted the original trilogy, from a very Taoist and Buddhist lens. And yet, when you get to Return of the Jedi, there's that turn in the end where Luke goes in a direction that his training told him not to, that his masters told him not to, that for all of Yoda's wisdom and mastery of the Force and Obi-Wan's, they could not see what Luke could see, which is that which was the good that was still in Anakin, the conflict that was still in Anakin, and that then there was still good in him, and that there was the potential for a kind of balance there. So what's interesting about all of that to me is how all of the movies, really, from the beginning, from the original trilogy, certainly, but including the prequels, and then also certainly including this new trilogy that's forming, you have this conversation about good and evil that breaks down those dualisms and complicates them in different ways, and sets you up to think that you actually get it, and then breaks it down over and over and over again. So, like Joe was saying, I mean, when we meet Luke, like he's a nobody. He's just he's just a farm kid, you know. Mm-hmm. And the great shocker for everybody in Empire was that, you know, he was Darth Vader's son. It was like mind blown. Like what? Mm-hmm. And so that then though sets up this whole idea that we have had then for all of these decades, or what, two decades, about, you know, what it means to be a Jedi, and we developed this idea that it's about lineage. And we're sort of set up, they set us up then to think that, you know, who are Rey's parents? You know, that's what everybody's obsessed with because, you know, but what I love about it is that in that moment, they do the same thing, but the opposite thing. The big shocker here in movie 2 of this new trilogy is who are Rey's parents? Nobody. They were nobody. You know, it's so to me, it's continuing in this legacy of, really breaking down people's expectations just as soon as you think you've got a handle on, you know, how this works, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys, and who's on the right side of what, and how, you know, how are you creating balance so that that these movies just they continue to break that down, to muddy up the waters. And to me, that makes The Last Jedi very much in keeping with the whole tradition of Star Wars. So I get really frustrated with people when they seem to think that somehow it's not authentic, you know, as you were saying.
But I agree with you that it does, because, and this is where it can move slightly from the theological, Lucas is a consummate storyteller. And so he understands the conventions of inverting expectations and confounding them. And when I talked about with the prequels having a more Christian vibe, it's mainly in the first one, when we're first meeting Anakin. But then again, he inverts it. But it's where it all comes back to again is, I think it's balance and it's choice. You know, Anakin makes a choice to not be a savior and to become a Sith. You know, Luke is making the choice to redeem his father and to leave his masters.
Right. And in that, I think I interpret that the original trilogy in the ending of that, Anakin's redemption, as a Christian turn within a trilogy that feels very Buddhist and very Taoist.
Absolutely.
Spirituality. And but at the very end, it's like, this is an extremely Christian narrative.
And I think that's what carries into the first prequel.
Right.
You know, well, we saw his redemption, but now we need to know why he needed to be redeemed. But again, I agree with Rabbi that it's also very much in all of these, but particularly in this one, you know, the parallels to, you know, this very formative period in history of both our faiths. And we were talking after Beer and Hymns when we were talking about doing the show, and I had made the observation, and Rabbi, you might want to either correct me or add on or change this, but it seems that the Jedi Council are the Sadducees. We control the temple and we get to say who does what and whose sacrifice counts. And if you're not of our lineage, you're not going to be a priest. Obi-Wan and reluctantly Yoda are Pharisees. They're willing to take this to the people. And it's about following a tradition. It's about training. But you don't need to have to be of this parentage. And it's not about the council in this temple on this one particular place. This is a practice. This is something that can be done.
Right.
And that Luke is an Essene who says, fuck all of you, you're crazy. I'm taking my books and moving to Qumran.
To a planet with very weird fish. Yeah.
Right. Which is Qumran.
Right.
I love that. And I want to ask Esther, if you take that as a metaphor, then who is Rey?
Well, you know, I do think it works, and I also think that they're stepping stones of meritocracy and democracy in that, right? Where obviously the most extreme and rigid position is the Sadducee position, which didn't work. And the Pharisees realized, you know, this brings me back to my Yohanan ben Zakkai analogy. They knew that in order to be viable, they needed to make this accessible, right? And that is, I think, a tension for many great innovations in religion, in spiritual revolutions, where, you know, the old ways have become calcified and the new ways want to open that up and break that down. So I do think that works. Now, who would Rey be in this equation? I kind of like the idea of Luke being an Essene, or maybe he is Shimon Bar Yochai. He's the mystic who's been sitting underneath his carob tree for like 12 years, and he still has that wisdom, but he's turned it so inwards that he's no longer connecting with the lived reality. So And who is Rey? Well, you know, potentially she's a messianic figure. We don't know yet. We don't know how her arc will develop. She could also be a very dark figure. We don't know yet. Maybe she's a little bit like Akiva-esque in that sense. Mm. Like, is she going to mm-hmm. bank on you know the false messiah and mm. you know in the face of oppression and empire make bad choices or choices that didn't work out as hoped and expected? Or is she going to give this amazing Torah, transmit this amazing wisdom for future generations? And, you know, maybe Akiva is a good analogy because there was wisdom and folly in his character. And we still live with that legacy. So I don't know. That's, I would have to think longer about it to come up with a more accurate answer, but that's where my rabbinic mm-hmm. gut instinct would take me.
Yeah. Certainly has the self-taught aspect also, because a lot of her wisdom yes. she acquires exactly, herself.
Right.
You
yes.
know. Yeah. So no, I think Akiva works, which is interesting because my first instinct when you asked the question, Kristen, was in some ways Rey, and I hope that they're not just toying with us and they're going to give her some fancy lineage. I hope they do stay true to her being from nobody.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean that because it is such a more beautiful message.
Absolutely. That would ruin it.
It would. Yeah. It would. It would. So in.
Well, it's also it's in keeping with I think where, you know.
Yeah, where we're Disney's going.
Trying to go with their you know sort of new.
Mm-hmm. But I think we could maybe. My first reaction when you brought up that question is who's Rey, is. Does Rey represent the diaspora and mm-hmm. the advent of mm-hmm. modern Judaism?
Yeah.
She mm-hmm. instead of her being representative of one of the teachers, again, maybe she's representative of us, mm-hmm. the recipient right. of the Jedi Council, of Yoda, of Obi-Wan, of Luke, even of Anakin and Kylo, the one and now takes this out. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a lived Judaism.
Yeah.
It becomes a lived Jediism.
I think that works very well, especially when you consider the last scenes of the film mm-hmm. where yeah. the resistance is decimated and they choose life, right?
Yeah.
They choose
yeah.
survival. They could be heroic and go down in flames and it would achieve absolutely nothing. But they are choosing survival and they're choosing to carry their values with them as they go into this exilic phase mm. and they have to regroup at some point. But they also realize, and I also think that's what makes the closing shot so powerful
right.
mm. is that there are so many sparks, you know, if I'm going to use an image from Kabbalah, from Luriana mm. Kabbalah, there's so many sparks of the Force scattered throughout the cosmos that are still to be gathered and that can still right. provide mm-hmm. us with hope and redemption mm-hmm. and healing. But you have to go out there in order to gather these mm-hmm. sparks. If you only have a center and no periphery, you cannot engage in your redemptive mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's that shot of that little boy at the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm sure also for the Disney kit people, it's also a Sorcerer's Apprentice, you know, illusion.
Yeah.
But it is, because I agree with
you. It's also like every little kid, you know, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Grew up with these movies and
yeah.
this and, yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so I'm hoping that, you know, she's more represents the taking of all of this and reintroducing it into the universe.
Yeah.
You know? And I do see a lot of Kabbalistic elements in the Judaism of the Jedi. I know a lot of people go with the Force as the divine, as God, as the ineffable. I take a more mystical Kabbalistic view. For me, the Force is not the divine. The Force is creation. In our world, the world of action, mm-hmm. it's what literally binds us to all of creation, and also as human beings, we're the only members of creation who do have a connection to the world above us, to the world of thought. And to me, that's what it's more of a mystical force than just simply saying the force is the divine. Mm-hmm. Rabbi,
that's interesting, because I'm gonna marry a few concepts here through Kabbalah, mm-hmm. because yes, I don't think we can understand the force as a traditional godhead that has a divine will.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's more of a passive agent that permeates all of being, and in that sense, I think the force is more like Shekhinah or Malchut in mm-hmm. the Kabbalistic uh-huh. tree of life. It's the lower levels of divinity that doesn't seem to cast moral judgments. It doesn't seem to have a will, but we can tap into it and use it for good or for ill, in fact.
Yes.
Right, so that it has that magical, mystical quality, but actually it's a type of pantheism or panentheism, mm-hmm. right? And so we never learn what lies behind the force, or what animates the force, or the origin story of the force. There's so many kind of theological unanswered questions in the Star Wars universe, but yeah, I never felt that the force was Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh. It wasn't mm-hmm. Adonai. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the transcendent creator God. It was more Shekhinah, the indwelling mm-hmm. presence of the divine, through which we, to kind of mix metaphors with Christianity, and the Christians will have to forgive me if I do this injustice, but, through whom we live and move and have our being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you all. It's been a really, really interesting, fascinating discussion, and one that I hope we continue.
Absolutely.
Because there's a lot of good stuff here. So I want to thank Rabbi Esther Huguenots. Thank you very much. You were part of
You're
the inspiration for this when I was
thank
reading
you.
Your thread. Joe Mitchell, thank you for joining us. And Kristen, thanks for stepping into Chris's I won't say large shoes because I don't know him that well. as always, it's always fun. And as we always do, we always try to leave you with some sort of wisdom, because it doesn't always come from us. And so I leave you with this quote, and I always put the disclaimer, these are all chosen randomly, without any agenda. And this comes from Christopher Stevens, the late ambassador to Libya, who said, "We wish we were Obi-Wan Kenobi, and for the most part we are, but there's a little Darth Vader in all of us."
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah.
Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire.
Shoulda woulda coulda, but I didn't, that's for real. You can't get back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you gotta live with that. If you learn from your mistakes, you'll get another chance at that.